Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It is Thursday, May 21st. We only have three more meetings, and then this committee will be closing down. Yay. All right. I'd like to open a public hearing on H.J.R. 12.
Madam Chair, H.J.R. 12 encourages public to take measures to decrease incidence of skin cancer.
And we have a representative from Representative Gelser's office.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kim Forrest, and I'm a legislative assistant to State Representative Sarah Gelser, who represents HD 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. Representative Gelser is very sorry she can't be here today. She was needed in another committee, but she wanted me to come and present this bill to you guys. This bill idea was brought to her by a dermatologist in her district, Dr. Abigail Haberman, who was concerned with the prevalence of skin cancer that she saw among young women who came into her practice. Representative Gelser has also submitted written testimony, which you should have in front of you, and I won't summarize it. You can go ahead and read it yourselves, but I will be happy to answer any questions. And thank you very much for taking the time to do this today.
All right. It's a pretty straightforward concept. I don't think we're going to have any problems with it, but since we don't have a quorum, we won't be moving it right now.
Okay.
All right. But with that, thank you very much, and tell Representative Gelser thank her for bringing it forward.
Okay.
Thank you. That'll close the public hearing on H.J.R. 12. And could you call Bates's office and Moore?
He went down to move his car. I rode down in the elevator with him. He said he'd be here.
Okay.
He's not in his office.
And Senator Cruz and Senator Morris. Not sure which one to go through with first. Well, let's open a public hearing on HB 2177.
And 34. Which one?
2177.
All right, Madam Chair, House Bill 2177 was passed out on Tuesday. We did get a conflict amendment from Legislative Council, and that amendment is a dash one and is in your packet. And it relates to Senate Bill 96, which is the definition of veterans, and I believe Mr. Mann is here if you need further explanation.
Would you come forward and describe what the dash ones do?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The Dash 1 amendment is a reconciliation amendment in a sense because you will recall Senate Bill 96 took six different definitions of veteran in statute and consolidated it into one definition under Oregon ORS 408225. That bill has been passed by both chambers and signed by the governor. Subsequent veteran bills, however, when they were drafted, retained the old language of a number of different veteran definitions. House Bill 2177 contains the word war veteran. So the amendment you have in front of you takes out the word war to make it reconciled with Senate Bill 96. So what all this amendment does is make sure that veteran is veteran as defined in 408225, and in this amendment the word war is removed in front of veteran as the modifier.
All right. So which one's for 2177?
Pardon me?
Which of these are for 2177?
We have to go through the whole thing.
Yes.
2177, and Senator Cruz has a script.
You have the script?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, any other further comments on this? All right, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2177.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2177.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2177. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, then the rules are suspended.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2177 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2177 was sent to the floor. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, and please note Senator Morris and Senator Bates are excused. If not, the motion If there's, I don't see any objection. All right, so let's just say that it passes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 conflict amendments.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the Dash 1 conflict amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Please note that Senator Bates and Morris are excused. Motion carries. The amendments are adopted.
That's it. Senator Cruz.
Now just move the
turn that over.
Aha. I hate these two pagers. Madam Chair, see, you put Mr. Chair in. It should be Madam Chair. Okay. I move House Bill 2177 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2177 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there? Well, let's have the clerk call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Excused.
Senator
Morris? Aye.
Senator Morris?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Montana? Aye. Motion carries. And who did we have carrying that bill? Well, you'll look up in the record, right? And that person is going to carry the bill. Same person. I don't want to change that, and I cannot remember. That'll close the work session on House Bill 2177. Let's see, 2177. Since we... Okay, let's open a work session on House Bill 2506.
Madam Chair, 2506 was adopted. It was passed with a to pass recommendation of the floor on Tuesday, the 19th. There was a Dash 5 amendment, which was supported by the committee. However, they did not take a formal vote. The Dash 5 amendment is in your packet, so we'll need to go back and review that and adopt the Dash 5 amendment.
And I would like to know who the Dash 5 amendments belong to. This is the health maintenance organizations may limit the receipt of covered services performed by a professional counselor and marriage and family therapist.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa for the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice. The Dash 5 amendments were from Kaiser. We had legal opinions. We thought that they were redundant and unnecessary, but Kaiser felt strongly about having them. It doesn't change the intent of the bill. The other insurers were fine with them. This was pretty simple. I think that what happened is you thought you had adopted them. They hadn't been officially adopted. We're just back here to say yes.
Okay. Now we have to bring it back. We've passed it out.
What would be helpful is to pass the Dash 5 amendments. I will then request a new fiscal, and we can address this next Tuesday.
But we hadn't passed out.
We had not passed out right. Dash 5, and Senator
okay.
Cruz has.
So we are in work session on House Bill 2506.
Okay. So you want to...
Do we have to go through?
We have to adopt the 5 amendments.
But we don't need
to. You don't have to suspend. Yet. You just have to adopt the 5 amendments.
We haven't adopted any of them
no,
yet.
No. This is just ready to go.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I thought the fiscals were back on the Dash 5s already. My memory was that that's what had happened, and I just wanted to make sure. Sorry.
Has amendments? We have the Dash 5 amendments? We have the Dash 5. We requested the Dash 5, Madam Chair, we requested the Dash 5 thinking that we had adopted the amendments. We had not, so we do have the fiscal on the Dash 5.
Oh, we do.
Yes.
Let's just find them.
Yeah.
I have the fiscal just on 2506. Oh, here we are.
But we do have to go through the reconsideration.
Why? Because we haven't moved the bill at all.
We moved the bill on Tuesday. We did not move it with the Dash 5.
That's what happened. Okay.
Okay. So
which is why
we need to...
We need to go through the script.
Yeah, okay. Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2506.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2177.
No, 2506.
2506. Motion's not debatable. Is there any objection to that motion? If not, then the rules are suspended.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2506 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2506 was sent to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there, if not, is there any opposition? If not, the major okay is once again before the committee.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2506.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2506. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any, is there any opposition? If not, the motion carries and the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2506 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2506 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Excused.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and I believe Senator Morissette was carrying this bill. That one I
even
do remember.
He
I'd like to open a work session on HJR 12. We're in a work session on HJR 12 because we already heard it. So we're in work session for HJR 12.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move HJR 12. To the floor with a due adopt recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves HJR 12 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Note that Senator Morris and Bates are excused. Motion, no opposition. The motion carries, and I will carry this bill and we'll close the work session on HJR 12. I still would like you to try to get Dr. Bates down here. All right, let us open a public hearing on House Bill 3471.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3471A requires Department of Human Services to work with the United States Department of State to implement requirements of Convention of Protection of Children and cooperation in respect to inter-country adoption for purposes relating to adoption of foreign children.
Okay. All right. Let's call Aaron Kelly Seal, Beth Englander, Gloria Anderson forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Kelly Seal, Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. Good morning, and with me are Beth Englander, Manager of our Adoptions Unit, and Gloria Anderson, who is the Manager of our Diversity Unit for CAF. We're here this morning to testify in support of House Bill 3471A. Already, you as Senate members have voted on a companion bill, Senate Bill 10, which originated in the Senate Judiciary Committee and which was sponsored in part by Senator Mona Sanderson. That bill addressed part of what House Bill 3471 addressed with respect to requiring the department to be in full compliance implementing procedures to allow us to fully take advantage of the protections that the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption will afford children that we are placing in other countries for adoption. Just by way of context and reminder, this is a very serious and complex issue for us. However, I think some perspective that's important to remember is that the department places children in other countries relatively rarely. In fact, between 1999 and 2008, 27 children total were placed in other countries for adoption, and those details are in our written testimony. We, on average, are able to place about 1,000 children a year for adoption, and in 2008, there there were 4 children total who were placed in other countries. So that's 0.4% of our adoption work happening in other countries, with other countries and with relatives in those countries. That being said, the issues, obviously, the interjurisdictional issues that are required of us when working with another country and relying upon that country for supervision of a child when a child is placed prior to the adoption being finalized are very complicated. And we really are, I think, very appreciative of the federal move to be more clear, more consistent, and play a much larger role for the United States State Department working with states so the conversations with other countries can be more equitable in nature. They can be from the perspective of country to country rather than the state of Oregon working with the country, for instance, of Canada, or one of its provinces, or the country of Mexico, one of its states. So I feel like we are in a much better position moving forward, working under the construct of Hague to be able both to have better information going into a decision around an adoptive placement and its ability that family's ability to meet the needs of an individual child. Also then what House Bill 3471 does, which is an augmentation over Senate Bill 10, is it requires the department to have very specific agreements with respect to supervision and monitoring of a placement of a child in that other country prior to the placement being made. And so logistically, the way this would work is we will go through the steps that are required of us pursuant to Hague that include enhanced home studies, enhanced work with the other countries in communication. Our judicial orders will look different now. There are a whole variety of steps that will be enhanced over current practice with respect to Hague, but also specifically we will have had conversations with that local child welfare, whomever the social service child welfare agency is in the community that will be working with the family, and we will have written agreement with that organization with respect to the kinds of supervision and monitoring that will occur and the kind of information we can expect to receive back from that country about that supervision and monitoring prior to the adoption being finalized. It gives us much more information about what's happening with a child when the child is placed in the receiving country prior to adoption finalization. It empowers us to be able to respond when something isn't going well more quickly and more readily, and it enables us, I think, to better support the family in the other country and the child and our worker and staff in this country to have the best information so that we can do the best work on behalf of that child. So with that, I will just really turn it over for questions, and thank you very much for allowing us to be here in support of House Bill 3471A. Yes.
thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, I think we had this conversation when you visited my office about this issue. I am very concerned that a child who is an American citizen who is placed with a family in a different country has all of the rights that an American citizen has, and that you make sure that the embassy, there needs to be a record. I think the embassy must understand that there is an American citizen who is living with a family, being raised by a family that is not a citizen of the United States. Now, I'm wondering what records there are when that child grows up and says, gee, I want to go to the United States. I hope that child understands that they are a citizen and that they can apply for a passport and not have to figure out a different way of getting here. That's what I'm concerned about. Now, as far as the protection of the child, if that child is registered, if the family understands clearly that that child is registered as a United States citizen, then that family will understand the ramifications and the safeguards and so on. That's so. Any response to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gloria Maria Anderson. Yes. In the situation that you're describing, that child would be considered a dual citizen, and absolutely his U.S. citizenship would continue.
Mm-hmm.
The way that many of the countries that recognize dual citizenship will handle that situation is that usually upon the child's 18th birthday, some its 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. Many countries require that that child, now an adult in that country, would select which citizenships that they would align with. But during that time, when they're a minor, absolutely. We, as a matter of fact, we would be sending that child to the other country with a U.S. with a U.S. passport. Mm-hmm. Is their passport.
Yeah. Okay.
We also would be documenting the placement of the child through Department of State in the United States as our central authority that this is a U.S. citizen being adopted. Mm-hmm. In the other country, in the receiving country. So that would all be documented.
Yeah, good.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think she had a response.
Oh, okay. Yeah, please.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Beth Englander, and for the record, I'm the Adoption Program Manager for CAF. And I just wanted to add that one of the requirements that we have under the Intercountry Adoption Act, which is the federal law attached with the Hague Convention Treaty, will be reporting to the Department of State children that are emigrating to other countries for the purpose of adoption, and they will be tracking those children also.
Good.
And I wanted to let you know that we are actually yesterday, just yesterday, I was advised that there is a new State Department official who is assigned to the Mexico desk for the purpose of managing children under, for the central authority, I should say, for the purpose of tracking and managing children who would be placed in Mexico, specifically each country that's a Hague signature. A signatory does have a desk person. So we are connected with that individual, and we'll be working closely with her to make sure that the tracking is happening and that all of the documents are in order and that we're able to get the follow-through that we need for home studies that are in question, that sort of thing. So,
good. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Yeah. I know, clearly about half the kids adopted out of country or to Mexico. There's been a couple interesting cases over the last few years. I've sat on a couple of central review committees where the Mexican consulate was at the table, and I know we have been doing some very good work to try to develop that relationship. And I know there's this international-national thing, which is all well and fine, but a lot of the work is between Oregon and Mexico, not the U.S. So does Hague deviate us in any way from the track we've been on in developing our relationship with the Mexican consulate for, because the front end stuff is what's really important here, you know, the home studies and that sort of thing, and also the relative search. So,
yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in response to your question, we truly recognize the importance of maintaining and continuing to develop that relationship with our consulate and consular staff in Oregon. And they are extremely supportive of the efforts. We have actually kept them informed and are scheduling yet another meeting so that, as you're saying, the first steps really do happen early on with notification requirements because of Vienna Convention requirements, separate from what we're discussing here.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, they are a big player in helping this process move forward, and it aligns very nicely with what the Hague Convention requires. And truly, for the staff, I just can never say enough of the consular staff that we have for Mexico in Oregon. They have been wanting to be at the table for many of these changes and enhancements that we're doing, and are actually even discussing how they in Oregon can impact much of the work, like you're saying, will happen within central authority in Mexico and within each of the states within Mexico to get them on board with this is what Oregon is doing, and ideally they would like this to be modeled for others, what we're doing and enhancing in addition to the Hague within the whole country of Mexico. So,
yeah, I mean, Madam Chair, that, you know, State Department involvement post-adoption is absolutely critical, but the front-end work is still the province of the state of Oregon to make sure that happens. And I recognize that you recognize that. I just want that on the record, so.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much. And Tasha, would you please come forward?
Thank you. I turned in a bunch of stuff I wanted you guys to get a look at, too. Before and after pictures of, you know, the reports that were made to the Mexican authorities that nobody responded to.
And so introduce yourself and tell us who
Tasha Cram, the mother of a victim of out-of-country placement. I guess I'll start with my testimony. I want to begin by thanking you for the roles that you play in addressing the policies intended to protect our vulnerable children. When children are placed in other countries, they remain under custodial responsibility of the state that arranges the placement. In this case, or in my daughter's case, that should have been Oregon. I want to point out that while these policies have potential to protect in foreign countries, the reality is that neither the U.S. nor individual states such as Oregon have authority to enforce their policies, laws, or procedures in other countries. So the safety and well-being of the children subject to being sent there is questionable at best, if not impossible, despite the efforts that might be made. Jim Perillo mentioned at one point, he was my daughter's state worker, that I followed all Oregon in-house procedures as if I would have if I was placing her in Michigan. Yet with my daughter Adriana's placement in Mexico, despite following procedures, the state did not, and possibly in some instances, could not fulfill its responsibilities. Although it was legally their responsibility. When the system, state, or government fails to carry out the responsibility to ensure safety, as in this case, there is never any recourses for the aggrieved, the innocent children who suffer, their grandparents, aunts, uncles, parents. These children are taken into custody to be, quote-unquote, protected. DHS in Oregon or any other state that takes custody of a child should be held accountable. Responsibility for decisions that permanently impact, or in my daughter's case, in lives. My daughter suffered months of starvation, humiliation, and brutal beatings that eventually killed her. It is deceptive and dishonest to both families and children to promise responsible custodial care while knowing that it is impossible to fulfill. These duties in out-of-country placements. The state of Oregon and the rest of America have responsibilities for their foster children in foreign countries. The state must acknowledge upfront its lack of contact, jurisdiction, and authority in foreign countries, limiting or disabling the state completely to carry out its duties. In my daughter's case, the state up to the present has simply hidden in silence behind its lack of jurisdiction in the attempt to absolve itself of its custodial responsibility to the children in their custody. If international adoption is allowed to continue, this scenario will repeatedly put the U.S. and individual states in a double bind with no escape. Adriana was in state custody, and they were responsible for her, or so you would think. But because she was placed in a quote-unquote foster home or adoptive family prelimium or whatever you want to call it, placement with her family that she'd never met before. Located in Mexico, they had no jurisdiction to carry out their responsibilities to her. At the same time, Mexico took no responsive action for her well-being due to the fact that Oregon was still held that Oregon still held responsibility for her until the completion of her adoption, which she didn't live to see. Oregon placed my daughter in a foster care no man's land and left her vulnerable and without protection to live with severe neglect and fatal abuse. The primary responsibility for this repeatable and preventable tragedy lies with the United States and the state of Oregon. They have the power to change the outcome and save innocent lives that could be potential candidates for international adoption in the future. The state of Oregon presented an appearance of approval of international adoption, international foster care, but was unwilling or unable to care for or protect my daughter. My daughter and others in her similar situation go unprotected with no one being held accountable. Unfortunately, she was held accountable for a lot of things she never deserved. Racism does exist in other countries. And it doesn't matter how old you are to have it taken out on you. The children pay the biggest price. While they owe nothing to no one and have never wronged anyone, children such as my daughter are robbed first of their right as an American citizen. Many children in state care are neglected and forgotten while in this country. Blood relation means nothing when the child is already in a family, even if it's not biological, that love them, take care of them, they're safe, and they're meeting their needs like my daughter was. And they wanted to adopt her. It's the state's responsibility to do right by these kids. They're already traumatized enough. One of the ironies in my daughter's case is that while I no longer had parental rights in the United States, in Mexico, my full parental rights were still intact and still actionable. While Oregon and Mexico both failed to protect my daughter, my defenseless child, they also neglected to communicate with me or any of her other biological family that I still had full parental rights with her in Mexico. If this communication would have been made and I would have been aware of the abuse my daughter was enduring, I would have and could have intervened to protect her despite Oregon and Mexico's failure to do so. The state failed me, my daughter, its citizens, its own agencies, and its commitment to protect its children. I believe our most vulnerable children are children in foster care. They are best protected while in the United States, where family violence has been illegal for years. Meanwhile, in Mexico, only recently have they started changing things to protect women and children. Please, baby. Sit. Change takes time, and habits are hard to break. When you grow up in an environment where they believe that family violence is okay, where do you put the limit? In my daughter's case, there wasn't one. My daughter's best interest, knowing that she had medical issues. I lost my daughter for medical neglect because I couldn't give her her pills because I was hiding from an abusive partner, her father, who beat me to a bloody pulp numerous times. And because of fear, I never did anything until I started realizing how it impacted my daughter. She was two different people when he was home and when he wasn't. So I finally got the nerve to leave. Bouncing between states, I lost insurance because you have to have a certain gap between state insurances and states. And I couldn't get it, so I begged and begged for help. Instead of preventing her needing to go into foster care and giving me insurance, I have appeal after appeal. They took my baby. It would save a lot more money if they would just try to help families. My only thing is, no matter what kind of laws this state makes, we're not Mexico, we're not Ireland, we're not Germany. And especially if, like in this bill, like it says, that all the responsibility will be on supervision by the other country. The authorities of the other countries will be responsible for more continuous physical visits, physical checks, one-on-ones with the kids. Who's legally responsible?
I've got 9 months or 7 months worth of abuse records, letters from teachers to the state government there that nobody responded to. They knew of my daughter's abuse. And via an interview that the Oregonian had with the woman in jail who is breastfeeding a newborn baby and will have that baby in prison with her until he or she is five. The woman that beat my child and my daughter didn't live to see five has a baby in prison until that baby's 5 years old. What kind of places are we sending babies to?
Tasha, your testimony is so compelling, and I know we're all feeling very, very sad that this whole thing ever happened. We can never bring your daughter back. And
no, but I can try to protect other kids.
Absolutely. That's why I'm so glad that you came to share your story, because it has a profound effect on us. And laws seem, you know, insignificant compared to the loss that you felt. But we really want this to never, ever happen again. And
we need to keep kids in America.
Why
are we sending them to strangers? If family members in America have to have had previous contact with that child, some kind of relationship, an established bond, why are we giving more leniency to people just because they're out of the country?
And I think that the department's going to take that into account, because we hear you. Any other questions for Tasha? I'm just so glad that she came. Thank you, Tasha, so much.
And I've got one more thing. I've got testimony from my daughter when she was alive, when she would explain every bump and bruise and cut and everything up until, you know, the end of regular abuse. You start trying to cover for the abuser.
I think all of us have heard about it through the papers, but it's more meaningful hearing you give it. Thanks, Tasha. And what's your other daughter's name?
This is Lenny, and my son's outside.
Lenny. Thanks for coming, Lenny.
Hi.
See you later.
You coming?
Right.
Bring your sister. Come on.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3471 and open a work session on House Bill 3471.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3471 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3471 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill. I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 3471, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2194.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2194A modifies the definition of medical insurance for purposes of medical Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. This bill has been heard over the last 3 weeks. There are two amendments in your packet, -3 and -4.
This is sort of controversial, everyone, and I think a couple of us have heard it before. Maybe all of us have heard it before, but I feel we need to get on the record one more time. We have the -3s. Is John Powell around to explain that, or is Rocky? Can someone explain the -3s? Maybe not. Someone find John Powell. Okay, but the reason we really are going to do is talk about the -4. So if Doug Barber and Jonathan Eames, first Doug Barber and Rocky come forward and explain the -4s. You're there for just information. Okay.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. These are health insurance agents around the state in support of the -4 amendments. The -4s expand the groups that would contribute to the high-risk pool. This is the high-risk pool, commonly referred to as OMIP. Everyone benefits from that pool, and it's our belief that everyone should help support it. Currently, only those in the commercial insurance market pay into the high-risk pool. That means people who buy individual insurance, small group insurance, and some large groups help support the pool. But there is a growing group that includes large self-insured plans and union trusts that do not support the high-risk pool. And it's the burden of that high-risk pool that is being shouldered by individuals and small businesses. The OMIP board, with support of the governor, came forward with this proposal. It was House Bill 2192, and it's a way to expand that pool so that everyone contributes, and it would lower, have the effect of lowering the assessment on small groups and individuals. I've heard, you may have heard, maybe three arguments about why we should not do this that I'd like to just address very briefly. One of them, they say, well, we're special. We're already doing the right thing by providing insurance to our employees. We shouldn't have to contribute to the high-risk pool. The reality is that everyone who already contributes to the high-risk pool is doing the right thing. They're all buying insurance. They're all providing insurance for their employees. But they do more than that. They contribute to the public good by supporting the high-risk pool with that monthly assessment. And as we're working through the process of healthcare reform, the high-risk pool is an essential building block in that. If we didn't have a well-functioning high-risk pool, we would have to be creating it. And if we were going to create it, we would presume that everyone would help support that. And that's what this amendment does. The second is the argument from the third-party administrators who say that they can't afford to pay this assessment, that some of them are small, and that this would be a burden for them. I think it's a misunderstanding of what the assessment is and how it works. The assessment currently is not a tax on big insurance companies. It doesn't come out of Regence's profits or LifeWise or ODS. We pay it. You and I pay it every month when we pay our insurance premium. They tack on an extra $4.50 or whatever the exact amount is for the high-risk pool. The same thing would be true for self-insured plans or union trusts. The third-party administrators are simply the collection agent. They would collect the money from the people who are insured, and then they would forward it on to the high-risk pool. And the third argument is the ERISA boogeyman in the closet. This is the same argument that was raised on around the premium tax that you heard in that joint hearing with the House committee. Couple of points there. You've seen legal opinions from top ERISA attorneys saying that this is not a violation of ERISA. There are, Rocky knows far more detail about this than I do, and I can let him fill in the gaps, but as I understand it, there are at least two other states, Tennessee and Mississippi, that are already have already implemented this tax. And they have not been challenged by any ERISA lawsuits.
Who is that again?
Mississippi and Tennessee, I believe. And finally, currently under the ERISA assessments, there is an assessment on stop-loss carriers. Those large groups that buy reinsurance, that buy stop-loss coverage. And so there is an OMIP assessment on the stop-loss carriers. The problem and the reason we need this legislation for large groups, for self-insured groups, is that more and more of the self-insured groups are dropping the stop-loss coverage. And so there was a lawsuit, an ERISA lawsuit, against OMIP around the stop-loss coverage because it was simply a way of assessing them for the high-risk pool. And Safeco filed that lawsuit, and Safeco lost in state court and federal court. It was upheld that this kind of a taxing mechanism assessment is legal. So I think the fundamental question is, do we really want a well-functioning, workable high-risk pool? And if we're going to have that, and if everyone benefits, is everyone going to pay? And the Dash 4 amendments would allow you to do that. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Senators, the reason I wanted Mr. Barber to talk about this is I truly feel we're putting more and more of the burden on small group and individual on the small group and individual market, and I feel that this amendment is the right thing. Unfortunately, politics is getting in the way of this, but I feel that we needed to hear it, and I've asked Rocky King to be here because I want Jonathan Eam and his attorney to come and talk about why they are against it. And with that, is there any questions for Mr. Barber? Okay?
I'll wait.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm from PacWest Communications, but I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Building Council, IBEW, National Electrical Contractors Association, and a number of TPA third-party administrators and I benefit administrators and others here to oppose the Dash 4 amendments. We had this discussion, as you probably all remember, on a couple of different fronts. First, on the on 2192, we had this discussion, as well as on the claims tax proposal.
For 2116.
For 2116, yeah. What is now 2116 was 2009. Was the iterations are many. But Mr. Barber had brought up three points that he wanted to discuss, and I think that those are important to flesh out because I don't think the argument or discussion stops there. It's important to understand what a third-party administrator is. They don't take on the risk. They're not an insurance company. In fact, what third-party administrators do is they actually help keep costs low for these self-insured plans. They do a lot of the functions that would drive up the cost of health care in a low-cap form. In fact, the proposed assessment is maybe higher in some cases than what they actually charge to the self-insured plans. But what I think this is all about, and where I think we need to focus our discussion, is obviously there's an issue with OMIP and being able to fund OMIP, but the issue is not with the groups, the self-insured plans that are actually offering the health care and doing the right thing. It's those that are not providing the health care where the problem is, and where those people who are not receiving health care are going into the OMIP pool, that's what's driving up the cost of health care. If we want to look at a solution to solve this problem, we shouldn't be assessing those, as Mr. Barber said, passing through the dollars to a self-insured plan who are providing the health care. Let's look at something more broad-based if we want to look at a solution to get employers who are not providing health care and who are, the folks that we represent here are at a competitive disadvantage by offering health care when other groups can come in and bid at jobs or whatever it may be at a lower cost because they're not providing health care. Well, that's not the right thing. What we have to focus on is how we broaden the base on those employers that are not providing health care currently. And to do it on folks that are actually providing the health care, I think, is two wrongs, an instance of two wrongs don't make a right. I feel and I understand the problems that Rocky has brought up. We've had conversations with him and his staff about the problems, but I don't think that this is the solution. This is not to say we're Jeff Knapp here is from Lane Powell to talk to you about the ERISA issues. He's obviously a lawyer, not my lawyer, Senator.
You knew what I meant. You know what I meant.
But he's here.
I'll go into that.
He's here on behalf of some of the third-party administrators, and I'll let him talk to that. But I really want to emphasize that I understand the intent, but I don't believe that this is the right way to go about bringing more people into the pool, bringing more people into the assessment to pay for these folks. The people who are not providing the health care are the ones that we need to figure out a way to bring in. Those are the ones that are contributing to the OMIP pool. Those are the ones that are driving up the cost. cost of health care. It's not the folks that are doing the right thing by providing health care. So we'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I have one question for Rocky King. Do all the self-insureds, do they also, are they assessed for the omit pool, like, not at all?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. The assessment currently goes against fully insured plans and reinsure and stop loss for the number of covered lives. So if you have a self-insured plan, you're a large employer with 2,000 employees, if you purchase stop loss coverage, then you are paying the assessment through the stop loss carrier, basically, or the stop loss carrier pays it. They generally pass it on, obviously. If you are a 2,000 employee employer and you do not purchase stop loss coverage, then you are not subject to our assessment.
Do you get some of the high risk people that those who are not assessed, do you get some of those people into OMIP?
Madam Chair, we do, and we have two avenues to get into OMIP. One is medical eligibility, people who have diabetes, multiple sclerosis, cancer. The other group is, and about 14% to 15% come from what we call portability coverage. For self-insured plans, after someone exhausts COBRA, there is no underlying portability. Like if you were with ODS or Kaiser, they provide portability coverage to those folks. But for self-insured plans, their employers, we provide the portability coverage when someone exhausts COBRA.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, well, we've got Rocky here. Is the number of self-insureds that have stop loss decreasing?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we believe that there is a reduction to some degree on stop-loss coverage, 50 to 75,000 lives, I believe, over the last couple of years. So the number of, but there's a decrease in number of people being insured in this state, too, just because of the cost of health insurance. But there is a greater shift, I think, in dropping some of the stop-loss coverage, especially after 9/11. As you know, a lot of that coverage pricing just went through the roof. And so we've seen some shift. We think there are about 600,000 self-insured lives in the state, and about half of those purchase stop-loss coverage and are thus subject.
Say that again.
About 600,000 self-insured lives, and about half of those have stop-loss or reinsurance, and thus are a covered life under our assessment. There are 200,000 to 300,000 or 350,000 self-insured lives that escape the counting that we do because they don't have stop-loss or reinsurance.
But the contribution to OMIP of a stop-loss would be less than that of a fully insured, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, that is not accurate. The legislature established our...
Percentage-wise, yes, but...
They base it on a covered life. So, for example, we're at $4.54 per month per covered life, and that is whether it's stop-loss coverage or whether it's fully insured. And that would be, and you made an argument on it's very high cost for a TPA. That is also sometimes equal to or can exceed a stop-loss premium. But that's passed through and picked up.
Okay. I would like for you to address the ERISA issue, and then you address the ERISA issue, because I think we have two different opinions here.
Okay, for the record, my name is Jeff Knapp. I'm an attorney at Lane Powell in Portland. Just a reminder on the way preemption works is that when Congress passed ERISA in 1974, it included a preemption clause in the law. And what that law says is that if a state law relates to an employee benefit plan, it's preempted by the federal law. And the purpose for that was to encourage employers to have employee benefit plans and not have to worry about complying with a number of different laws that could be imposed by 50 different states. Now, there's a very important exception to preemption, which is state laws regulating insurance. Those laws are not preempted. We don't contend that they are. So, and the reason for that, for including that provision in ERISA, was because the states traditionally have regulated insurance, and so they didn't want to change the complete structure of how regulation had occurred in the past. But with regard to self-funded plans, the state laws are preempted by ERISA. Now, the United States Supreme Court has said that the purpose of that preemption is to minimize or avoid the administrative and the financial burden that would be imposed on plans of having to comply with different and sometimes conflicting directives among the different states or between the federal government and the state governments. Now, what this covered lives assessment does when it's applied to third-party administrators of self-funded plans is it imposes a direct financial burden on the plan. That's the very core of what ERISA preemption says you cannot do. And the testimony here today was that the TPAs are just a collection agent and that we all know the plans have to pay this amount. That, to me, that would be Exhibit A in a preemption lawsuit, because what this law does is it imposes a financial burden on the plan. It also imposes administrative burdens on the plan because of the requirement to report the covered lives assessments to the state of Oregon. Now, of course, what would happen is the OMIP board would then have the right to come in and audit the plan to confirm that the report was accurate. If the plan or the third-party administrator administers or if the plan covers employees who are in other states, if this kind of a law is not preempted, other states could impose different or additional requirements. For example, maybe an assessment based on claims paid, an assessment based on number of employees covered versus number of covered lives. And the third-party administrators, that is the plan, would have to collect all of that information for all of these different states and report it. Again, that's the exact result that ERISA preemption is intended to avoid. With regard to the Safeco case, it is true that an assessment can be imposed on a stop-loss insurer of a self-funded plan, but that's because of the exception I mentioned to preemption, which is state insurance laws are not preempted. So an assessment on a stop-loss insurer is not going to be preempted because that's an insurance law. And the court cases are clear on that.
All righty. Rocky, do you have any comments on the ERISA issue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Rocky King, the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. I'm not an attorney, so I don't want to get into with an attorney. I can tell you the
I
two.
I know a good one for you. Though.
Yeah, thanks. I can tell you the two other states
that have gone about you.
And successfully so far. I know that some of the debate around the Safeco suit that was filed in 1993 or 92 when I was here, and we won in both state and federal court. Thirdly, this is what courts are for. There are two opinions. We can parade, I guess, a number of articles that says and legal briefs that says this would be allowed, but that's something that will eventually end up in court if somebody so chooses to do that. We believe it's the right thing to do. It's good policy. Now, whether it's good politics, that's your call, but it is good policy, we believe.
If we did pass this, and I will be upfront, we're not passing this today, but if we do pass this at some point in time and there's a lawsuit, where does the attorney fees come from for the state?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the fees would come obviously from the OMIP program, and they would be paid through the assessment because we don't have...
That's right, an attorney fund. All right. Yes, Senator Bates.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the discussion. It's one we've had for 20 years and probably 30 or 40 years. I've been involved for 20 years. And every time I go through this again, it reminds me of medieval times when people were trying to prove that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun revolved around the earth. And they had these huge, incredible, intricate models to prove that to be true. And they never could quite get there, but it was the standard understanding for a couple hundred years till finally we recognized the truth and realized that Earth revolved around the sun. And what this whole discussion calls out for, and I think Jonathan Ames actually has it right, he must have a good lawyer somewhere, he's helping him out, is that sooner or later, we have to get to a single pool, and we have to start bringing health care costs down. Mm-hmm. And that calls out for some form of a broad-based tax that actually funds these programs and gets the cost of an incredible burden on business of health care off the backs of those employers who are doing the right thing and ensuring their employees, and allows employers who truly can't afford with their type of small businesses to insure their employees an option to go into a program that does so. It's we're going to have to move in that direction sooner or later. We will continue to have these arguments about what I consider where the sun goes around the earth, earth goes around the sun, until we actually come and settle with ourselves. The truth is, we've got to make a transition from a system that no longer works and to a system that will work, and that is a broad-based tax that resolves this issue. There's no other way around this, and ultimately that's going to happen. The question whether it does federally or state, whether it's this year, next year, or 10 years from now, this is cannot continue. What's going to happen, I believe, is exactly what you spoke to. We are squeezing down the small insurance market to the point that you'll be left with self-insureds and nothing else. And that when that happens, it collapses. And the small employers, which make up the majority of people who are insured, who are working in this state, can no longer afford insurance for anybody, then the self-insured stand alone. And that's when it crashes. I would like to see us move before that. And we're doing things now, and I recognize that Senator Cruz has been working very hard on this very issue, sort of a sidebar issue, which I think he's going to bring to us, hopefully, in the next session. And I would be very supportive of that when he's got it ready.
Would TPAs go away?
And Senator Morris, too. I'm sorry. Left you out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jonathan Eames again. Here's the problem: is that there's a competitive factor. Third-party administrators are very competitive because their costs are very low and they keep their costs low. If an assessment were to happen here, there's a question about whether out-of-state TPAs, which do serve some of the trust funds that are in the state, whether they'd be able to continue to exist, because out-of-state TPAs, it's questionable about whether they would be able to be assessed as well. So you would have some third-party administrators probably go out of business because they would not be able to continue to be that competitive, because the margins are very, very slim. This is not, you know, a high-profit business. So, yes, I think the unintended consequence, which you would see some Oregon companies, which are small companies as well, have a problem not only from the insurance side being able to pay this assessment, but also from the third-party administrator side.
Well, I guess the point I'm saying, we are going to be changing the system.
Absolutely.
It's just like a slow mule going up a hill. But we are, it's going to change, and I would hope that TPAs are going to be at the table, because your interests are there too, because
Absolutely.
Change is coming. And that's why I'm not comfortable moving it now, because we are getting some really significant, I feel, health care reform through this session. But this issue is not going away, and I know that we're going to be addressing it.
Madam Chair, I disagree, I guess. I think we ought to move it and work toward a solution. Let the courts make a decision and see what happens. We're going to postpone it one more time and come back next time, maybe. I think we ought to move the floors and move the bill. I think you have the votes on the committee to do that.
All right. Any other comments? All right. With that, we aren't going to be discussing the A floors, and I do agree, actually, with Senator Morissette, but there are other factors that we need to be considering. Unfortunately, politics gets in the way. I need someone to come up and talk about the dash A3s, and I thought I saw John Powell, but now he's gone. So Doug Barber. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Doug Barber pinch hitting for John Powell.
Thank you.
John had to run down to the Speaker's office on a meeting about tax issues. The dash threes are a cleanup amendment. There was one line in the bill that sort of undid an assessment that's already there on the first page of the bill. It was a straight cleanup. It was an oversight, and I don't believe there's any controversy.
No.
On the A4s. I mean, on the A3s.
No. All right, we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2194.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2194. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, you don't like this, but I'm going to move the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2194.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A4s to House Bill 2194. And I think we do have three votes, so we will close the work session on House Bill 2194. All right, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2056.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2056A increases number of public members on health regulatory boards.
Susan Colback. Okay.
I have lost track of the amendments in this thing.
Chairman Moniz Anderson and members of the committee. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Colababa. I'm here today representing Service Employees International Union, SEIU. SEIU represents over 50,000 workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We represent over 500 CNAs. I'm here in support of House Bill 2056, in particular, adding a CNA, which is a certified nursing assistant, to the Board of Nursing.
Oh, I should have had you describe.
The board currently has registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and public members. It does not have a CNA. CNAs are regulated by the board, but do not have a formal voice in matters that affect their patients and their work life. The 18,000 CNAs in Oregon should have a voice on the Board of Nursing, on the board that regulates their license. I've been in healthcare for over 23 years, and I've worked closely with CNAs for many years. CNAs are the providers of direct patient care in both nursing homes and hospitals. They are passionate about providing excellent patient care. They should have a voice in the decisions made by the Board of Nursing that affects their patients. In the last few years, there have been changes to the regulations that CNAs work under, the CNA 2 regulations and requirements. There was not a CNA on the Board of Nursing at that time. There was a lot of confusion about how to roll out the regulations into the real world of hospitals. If there had been a CNA on the board, this process would have greatly benefited from that person's knowledge of the real world practices in hospitals. I'm also a steward for SEIU Local 49, and I've seen that when people who do the work are part of the decision making, it is a win for patients in improved care and a win for workers who feel valued. CNAs know the work of CNAs. Workers feel valued when they are part of decision making processes that affect their work lives. This bill will improve patient care and improve the lives of these workers. Give CNAs a voice on the Board of Nursing. Their contributions will enhance the depth of expertise on the Board of Nursing. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Colleagues, this is why don't you describe the bill, since we didn't have someone describe the bill to us.
Madam Chair, 2056A increases the number of public members on health regulatory boards. This is the first time I've heard this bill. We have done our conflict search, and LC told us last night there is a conflict amendment coming. Mm-hmm. We should have that by Tuesday, so we will await that amendment.
So we do have the A and Gross. And colleagues, I have really gone through this very carefully, and really feel that there's been some really good work on this. I don't have any, I do have a couple of questions, not for you, Susan, but for Tom
Powers.
Powers, would you come forward? I don't know if you can answer these questions, but at least we'll get them on the record. You'll be able to get them for us. Thank you, Susan. The questions that I have are regarding the Board of Radiologic Technology. We added an extra public member, yet it doesn't seem like in the graph that you gave me what you decreased or what you increased, because in your
okay.
Yeah, and I was just wondering how we could add another public member and still not increase the size of the board. So if you'll check on that, or maybe you have the answer now.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, Tom Powers, I work for Representative Mitch Greenlake, chair of the House Committee on Healthcare. The Board of Radiologic Technology was amended in this bill to add a public member without taking away any other member provisions in the bill from another licensed professional. That was done partly because the committee wanted to leave the Board of Radiologic Technology alone because of the pending House Bill 2245, which is before the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. And that bill would change the Board of Radiologic Technology, the name of that board, to the Board of Medical Imaging, which would bring in three new fields: sonography, medical resonance imaging, and nuclear medicine. And it would also change the makeup of the board to reflect these professions with a seat for each, I believe, maybe not for each of those new professions, but there would be a sonography seat, and I think there is already a nuclear medicine seat that would be reflected. So the committee, is my understanding that they thought that would be taken care of in House Bill 2245, and that bill awaits further action in that subcommittee.
Madam Chair, if you read Section 7, it's still a 9.
Yeah, it's still a 9. And so that's why I wanted to make sure that, you know, just to I need clarification as to, is the number correct, and if we need to have an amendment to change.
No, Madam Chair, if you read Section 7, the requirements, it's still 9. I think where the adjustment was made probably was we had at least another that's now being must, but the, like, for example, it had five, at least five licensed practicing radiologic technologists, and they could have had 6. So really they can't have any more in any category than what's in Section 7, but if they have what is in Section 7, it adds to 9.
Right. I know that, but the original then was 8, and yet in the original bill they only had, they said they had 9 members. It's just a little detail.
Well, originally, current law, it's 9 members.
Right, and okay. It's just not reflected in the graph, so I don't know where that extra member is. Okay, that's details that we will work out because we're going to need conforming amendments. The other question I had was the Board of Respiratory Therapists, and with 3232, I was confused as to what happened to House Bill 3232, And we now have, originally we had 5 therapists. This bill makes it 3 therapists with 2 public members. And is this really what the Board of Respiratory Therapists wanted? Or did you have testimony on that?
Madam Chair, committee members, the Board of Respiratory Therapists was amended by House Bill 3232A, and that is the bill submitted by the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. That bill was passed from the Committee on Healthcare in the House to the House Committee on Rules, where it is scheduled for next Wednesday. That bill changes 2 makeups. For the Board of Direct Entry Midwives and the Board of Respiratory Therapists. So we're not sure if that bill is going to make it out.
Because I was thinking that maybe we should have an amendment then that would put the therapists to 4 therapists and 1 public member, but then we don't have the therapist board here. I'll talk with you later, but that was another problem I had. And then on the board of direct entry midwives, we had gotten a lot of flack from a number of midwives, and I need explanation regarding the difference between a direct entry midwife and a certified nurse midwife.
Madam Chair, to explain the difference between 2056 and 3232, 3232 was considered as a policy bill for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, which included a couple of membership changes. With respect to the Board of Licensed Direct Entry Midwives, the original bill had the direct entry midwives retain four seats. The nurse midwives went down to one seat, and the difference between those two professions is licensed direct entry midwives are what committee heard testimony on were the home birth movement professionals who are not nurses. The direct or the certified nurse midwives are licensed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and the licensed direct entry midwives are licensed by the Board of Licensed Direct Entry Midwives. And also on that board is one MD who is an obstetrician and one public member under House Bill 3232A. Currently, there's no public member, so this bill would just simply add a public member in 3232A. And 2056, what the House Committee on Healthcare decided to adopt was an amendment proposed by the Oregon Nurses Association that added two members, or brought every board that did not have two public members up to two public members at least, and that was across the board. Boards that already had two or had more than two were left alone in that bill.
So what does the Board of Direct Entry Midwives want? One public member or two public members? I mean, we have two bills that are in conflict here. And I sort of wanted to be sort of consistent. If both bills are going to pass, what are we going to have?
Chairman Anderson, the House Committee on Healthcare went with an amendment to 3232 that adopted the form you see here, four direct entry midwives, two certified nurse midwives, one MD, one public member. The Oregon Council of Midwifery wanted to reduce the certified nurse midwife seat by one so that there would only be one certified nurse midwife, but the committee did not think that was appropriate because they wanted some supervision.
Well, so just one other, so I don't lose my train of thought. So I think that the direct entry midwives certainly don't want the majority of the board to be other people. And that's why I was thinking, should we be doing an amendment that gives the language to that you have in 3232? And I guess that's what I'm thinking, and I just need to have clarification.
Chairman Anderson, that would be consistent with the House Committee on Healthcare's work on 3232A, where that decision
okay.
was made.
All right.
A little bit more consciously. With the 3232 makeup, the board would be a total of eight members, four of which would be licensed direct entry midwives, and four, the other four would be one public member, two certified nurse midwives,
great.
And one
officer. So we will get amendments drafted, and I think I know what to do, and I'll make sure that when I get the amendments back, we'll go over to make sure that the amendments would be what is in Bill 3232 that is in rules, you say, in the House. Correct, because that to me, I would listen to your testimony or Representative Greenlick committee's testimony. It made more sense to go with this language and put it into 2056. All right.
Well, Madam Chair, I can't decide if we're playing bingo or having an auction here. It's a little difficult to tell. And can we bring that bill into one committee and have a little testimony and then have a decision, or do you feel comfortable it's moving forward with
well, I've been actually, we should have all those boards coming here. I don't know if we have time.
Why is it in rules in the House?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, House Bill 3232A was the Oregon Health Licensing Agency's kind of policy revamp bill for this session. It included a provision that the House Health Care Committee debated about, and that was creating a crime, I think it was a misdemeanor, if a tattooing artist or a body piercing artist were to tattoo or pierce the genitals of a minor. And that was some debate. There was an amendment to take that out, there was no amendment before the committee. However, it was sent to rules because there was a problem once that was moving to the floor with creating a crime. I understand that it's already within rule, not the practice of licensed tattooing artists and body piercers to do that, but creating a crime, I guess, was a little much for some people, and the bill between being referred to health or from healthcare to the floor and being heard on the floor went to rules.
And that's why I wanted to take the good pieces out of.
And Chair, I am sorry I asked.
232. Okay. If you will be working with Mr. Shook and me, I think I know how to how to draft the amendments for this. Okay. Yes. Then.
Just one question. Are there demonstrated problems with the makeup of the boards as they are now? Do you have a list of all these boards and all the problems that have been created with the current board makeup?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, I have no such list.
Okay, so we are solving a problem that doesn't exist. Okay, thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate your input. We will still work on this. I think that the intent was to get some more consistency amongst all the boards, and I think this has been actually a very healthy process for myself because I now understand the boards a whole lot better than I did before, so I will be a better chair because of it, all right? All right, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2056. And we need to open a work session on House Bill 2058.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2058.
My last bill.
Was heard on Thursday or last Tuesday, and it standardizes health profession regulatory boards. You would think that would solve the problem, but however, on Tuesday, this committee adopted -7, -8, -9, and -10 and moved the bill to the floor. The Legislative Council said there was a conflict amendment, which you have in your packet. They have created a -11, which includes not only the conflict amendments, but the -7, -8, -9, and -10.
And so before we do anything, colleagues, I have not, since I just got this conflict amendment today, I truly want to go through it carefully to make sure that it is correct, and I'd like to have Representative Greenlick's office do the same. So if you don't mind, I want to make sure that that this amendment is okay. I've been putting too much energy into it to have this amendment come forward without me having the time to actually go through and see what it actually did. So with that, I will close the work session on 2058. Let's carry over 2058, 2056, 2194. Did we pass out 2177?
We adopted the dash ones. I have to get a fiscal.
Carry that one over.
Which one?
2177. Yeah. So we're carrying over 2506, 2058, 2177, 2194, and then we passed out.
We did the rest of them.
And we did the rest of them.
Yes.
We passed out the rest. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, and we're adjourned.
Now we'll hear these on Tuesday.